Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Sorry for the delay, myself, and I know Senator Roblin had bills, separate bills that are in front of rules, and because of their schedule and because of another member having a higher priority in giving testimony, that is why we're running late. So with that information, we have two bills for a public hearing and I will and possible work session. What I'm going to do is go ahead and take the testimony today. There are, let's say, a lot of activity occurring in the building, and I've been asked not to move the bills today. So with that in said, let's start with, let's see, Representative Barker, you're here on 4035 or both of them? Okay. Why don't we go ahead and open up a public hearing on, I'm going to go ahead and open up for the purpose of getting Representative Barker's testimony on House Bill 4035A as well as House Bill 4068A. And Bill, why don't you give us an overview of each of those separate?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4035A comes to you from Representative Barker. It allows a corrections officer employed by the Department of Corrections to possess a weapon in the officer's personal vehicle when the vehicle is in DOC parking lot. If the officer is present in his official capacity, he or she has a valid Oregon concealed handgun license, and three, the weapon is in a locked container, including the glove compartment of the trunk inside the vehicle.
All right. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jeff Barker, House District 28. This bill would allow corrections officers to carry their weapon to and from work, and especially out in Eastern Oregon where they have many, many miles to go. They're in uniform for their own safety. They'd like to be able to carry their firearms. They've done that for years and years, and I think 2 years ago, the department prohibited them from bringing the firearm in a car onto the parking lot, in the parking lot. And so I had a bill last session that I thought would help fix that. The bill got caught in the politics of the building. I wasn't allowed to move the bill, so I brought it back this time. And we passed it on the other side. We changed it somewhat. It's more restrictive than for a citizen. Any citizen can have a gun locked in their car. This requires the corrections officer to have a concealed handgun license. I've talked to the director. I spoke with the director, and we talked about the possibility of having gun lockers like they do at courthouses for police officers to show up, be able to put them in. They can't do that financially right now. The director told me that they would be working on that, and that was something they would desire to do. I don't want to wait another year. I don't want to put these people out there. I think it's a matter of safety for the officers, and I want them to be able to protect themselves.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. Questions for the representatives? Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, Representative Barker, so these are their own personal weapons, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Personal weapons in their personal vehicles.
Okay, thank you.
So why don't we go ahead and get the review or cap on the other bill that Representative Barker wants to give testimony on. So, Bill, can you tell us
the summary on 4068A? You also have the -4 amendments in front of you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The bill comes to you from Representative Gumberg and Representative Thatcher. And what it does, it allows a person convicted of one violation and one misdemeanor for marijuana possession to apply for concealed handgun permit regardless of whether the conviction was in Oregon or another state. If I could, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, under current law, you have to wait 4 years for a misdemeanor before you can apply for concealed handgun permit, except where it's a drug offense. Okay. Under current law, if you're convicted of a violation for marijuana possession, you can obtain a concealed handgun permit. The bill, as originally drafted and as passed out of the House, would have allowed a person with one misdemeanor conviction for marijuana possession on one violation, whether in-state or out-of-state, to obtain a concealed handgun permit. How it differed from current law in the sense that you could have applied right away for a misdemeanor possession of marijuana. The Sheriff's Association came to us yesterday. They spoke to you. They spoke to me. I went down and helped them get the -4 amendments, which would basically say that you would have to wait 4 years if you had, were convicted of marijuana possession of marijuana. So it'd be similar to another misdemeanor violation. Excuse me, another misdemeanor conviction.
Is that exclusively for misdemeanor?
Mr. Chair, the violation would stay the same in and out state. It would be the misdemeanor at 4 years, as other misdemeanors are treated.
I've got a question regarding the amendment that we have in front of us. It's dated today. When did we receive it, and has it been properly posted?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it was. It will be, I think we received it this morning. I think we posted it at 8:15. Right around 8:26, ma'am.
Well, I guess we need to know what time we posted it.
Okay.
Because at this point, if it's not properly posted, we're not considering it at this time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll go back and check, but I think it was somewhere between 8:15 and 8:26. I'll get you the exact time.
All right. Representative Barker.
Thank you once again, Representative Jeff Barker, House District 28. This bill, we kind of joked about it, was a gun bill and a marijuana bill. It's really a fairness bill. And what this bill does is allow somebody, if I was 18 years old and got arrested for a small amount of marijuana in Portland years and years ago, I could get my concealed handgun license. If the same arrest had been just across the bridge in Vancouver, I couldn't because it was out of state. This does is put everybody in the same footing, recognizing that a small amount of marijuana is not a very serious crime and certainly not one that should keep a citizen from having the rights to have a concealed handgun license. I spoke briefly with the Sheriff's Association this morning. They have some amendments, which you were talking about, to try to clean it up. Apparently there was we'd left some things out, as sometimes happens. And I think this is a good bill and should pass.
All right, I'd like to get your comments on the amendments, but at this point I'm not ready to take testimony until I know I got an hour to notice on it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Any questions for the representative at this point?
Thank you very much, committee.
Jeff, thank you
Mr.
very much.
Mr. Chair, appreciate it.
All right, so what we're going to do, I've got open both of the hearings, and that was for the purpose of getting Representative Barker's testimony. I'm now going to recess the testimony on the public hearing on House Bill 4068A. We're going to continue with the open public hearing on House Bill 4035A. I have three people that are currently scheduled to give testimony, at least have signed up. And what I'm going to do is bring, it looks like there's going to be four, Mary Botkin, Tim Woolery, I believe, and Jack Dempsey. While they're coming up, is there going to be anyone else who wants to give testimony today on 4035A? Okay. Well, yes, I've got you down on the list. All right, who's going to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Woolery. I work for Oregon Assembly Council 75, and I am their corrections coordinator, and my responsibility is supervising and representing the labor needs of 1,800 correctional security members, as well as 1,200 security plus the people that do the other jobs in the prisons. And we are here today in support of this bill. Our members would like the ability to carry their personal firearms to and from work. We've had one of our members murdered on the way to work just recently, a couple years ago, Buddy Heron over in Eastern Oregon, who stopped to help what he thought was a stranded motorist. Turned out it was a bad guy. Earlier than that, in 2002, another one of our members was murdered on the way to work. Her ex came while she was getting in the car to go to work and murdered her. So we feel this is an important protective mechanism for our people to be able to protect themselves with their personal firearms on the way to and from work.
All right, who's next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Botkin with AFSCME, Council 75. Just so you know, the bill comes over with a strong support out of the House, 53 votes in favor. It really is a pretty simple little safety bill for our folks, and I'll just answer any questions if you have them. Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Jack Dempsey representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. We represent just over 700 workers in four Department of Corrections facilities. We also support this measure. We believe this is a public safety measure for our folks. And I will leave it at that and happy to answer questions.
All right, questions? All right, I have one question. I've talked to Mr. Dempsey about this morning. I've reviewed the bill, and I've also received a phone call from the Director Peters last night. She'll be testifying shortly, and I've now received word from the executive branch as to not wanting the bill to move forward today because there are some concerns on the executive branch side. One of the things that concerns me at this point, if it is a concern, is to maybe allow for an alternative instead of having the firearms stored in a vehicle, instead having them stored in some type of locked facility at the facility, meaning the corrections. So I'd like to know if there was an amendment that added that would allow for the Department of Corrections to provide their officers with a facility, a locker type setting, so when they came onto the premises, they could then take their guns and secure them into a locker type scenario, just as we have when officers go to a jail, they disarm themselves and put it into a lock facility. The proponents would consider that type of amendment. So in other words, it would allow what is currently in the bill unless the Department of Corrections provided another secure facility for those guns to be stored while they're on duty at their place of employment.
AFSCME would not have any objections to that kind of an amendment.
We would support that proposal.
All right. Any questions based on what I've just asked?
I have a comment, Mr. Chair. I think that the two situations they've talked about, people murdered when they're on their way to work or leaving work, I think that will not be covered by that amendment. That is a concern for me.
Why wouldn't
I think they should...
Why wouldn't that be covered by that amendment if they can actually get to the place where they work and then they secure the gun while they're at work in the secure place, they then take it out and then they can drive back home?
Well, from their car to the place and back. But the overreaching problem is those who have concealed carry permits have this right. We all have the same right. Why shouldn't they be covered under the same laws that we're covered under, which is we can carry our guns in our cars and lock them in our glove compartments? That's a right we all have. Why wouldn't they have that same right? That's the question.
Well, they would have that right under this bill. The other issue is liability as to how the gun is being stored, as to who would have the liability. In fact, for an individual that has a CHL, that could actually secure their gun at a facility such as the DLC and not have it just in their car where it could be stolen, where they could actually be sued for having the gun in their car that could be used in a way that seems to be a benefit for those individuals. Yes.
Chair and Senator Close, just to briefly answer your question, the current reason why they cannot do that, bring their gun to and from work, is there's a DAS policy that prohibits weapons on Department of Corrections grounds.
Follow up?
Yes.
I think there's a number of agencies that do that. There's companies that do that, but I believe it has been tested in courts because the law says that you can. And we've had this problem with school districts, teachers that can have concealed carry permits, carry them for protection on the school grounds, and that was a court case. And you do have the right to carry, but it has not been upheld by the courts, is my understanding.
Counsel Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Close is right as it relates to concealed handgun permits in public buildings. However, there's another statute, 162.185 and 162.135, which talks about contraband. And so I think that considerably clouds the issue. Arguably that if someone had a concealed handgun permit and went on the grounds of the Department of Corrections, that would be considered contraband. And so it's considerably less clear in this area as it would be, say, to another public building.
Well, also, I believe that through employment agreements, there can also be limitations, which we've seen in the K-12 school system. Other comments? Thank Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir.
We have Colette Peters scheduled to testify.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Colette Peters, Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I am here to testify in opposition of the bill as written. The department has historically opposed this concept for two reasons. One, the safety and security challenges the concept poses for the operation of our Oregon prisons, and the significant legal liability issues that are raised by permitting firearms on the grounds of our correctional institutions. However, we recognize that times have changed. We recognize that there are events that have happened inside our agency and across the country as it relates to corrections, and we are willing to explore this issue further. These concerns include but are not limited to the safety of our staff during those long commutes, as AFSCME just reported. We are in the process of fully exploring the legal liability issues raised by this concept, both with the Department of Justice and with DAS, and our own Inspector General has been engaging in research as we prepared for what we thought was going to be a conversation in the 2015 regular session. We believe it is critically important that we fully explore the legal liability issues. If we are going to make this policy shift, the legislation must properly address the state's liability. Finally, I believe that the legislation should also address the personal safety concerns of all of our employees with concealed handgun license, not just the department's security staff, as the bill is currently written. The department is committed to work with our employees and our labor partners to ensure the safety and security of our institutions and our facilities and the adults in our care and custody. However, the policy and legal issues raised by this concept are very complex. We have been working with DOJ and DAS and our Inspector General, as I mentioned, to prepare for what we hoped would be a conversation in the 2015 session. I am happy to talk in more detail about those legal complexities if the committee is interested. Before I conclude and offer myself up for questions, I did want to clarify that this has been a long-standing policy. I know that Representative Barker testified that this was a recent change. It has not been over the decade that I have been with the Department of Corrections. This has been the policy. And I would also like to clarify that because of the contraband statute that Counsel Taylor pointed out, we would seek prosecution if someone did bring a weapon onto one of our properties under the contraband statute. So citizens cannot, as that statute is written and as our policies proclaim, bring a concealed weapons permit onto our property today. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
So I guess the first question is, how long have the discussions and research been ongoing that you referred to?
As I said just a minute ago, historically we have opposed this concept. So it wasn't until after the last legislative session that we began our research. So we have the Department of Justice currently exploring this issue. We didn't raise it to the top of our list, Senator, because we were under the assumption that we would work with AFSCME for the 2015 session. So the Department of Justice, as an example, has surveyed all 50 states to find out what best practices are, how other states are dealing with the lockbox issue and the securing of the weapon, what do their policies look like. They've heard back from a handful of states, but less than a half dozen at this point. We're also analyzing how this would impact our facilities from a land perspective. If, for those of you that have been to our facility in Pendleton, as an example, we have two parking lots. One is state-owned, one is owned by the city. How would this legislation impact that conversation? We've also been exploring through our Inspector General, what should the parameters be around a lockbox? How detailed should we be in the prescription of what that means for our employees as we have this conversation?
And let's see. These objections that you're raising today, were they raised in the House side?
They were, Senator.
And regarding an amendment to the bill that would provide for DOC to provide their employees with a secure facility to lock, would you prefer that or the bill as it is?
Mr. Chair, we're still exploring that issue. That's one of the issues that the Inspector General is considering. We think from a programmatic perspective, just the practicality, not knowing how many employees would actually come to work with concealed carry. As an example, at our Snake River Correctional Institution, we have 800 employees. We currently have some lock boxes on the property for when the state police come to engage in an investigation inside our facility. But the logistics around how many that might be and how complicated that might be as people are coming to work is still unknown for us. So if you're asking my preference, it does seem to me that the lockbox in the trunk would be more manageable from a department perspective, but we're still exploring what that would look like.
Yes, Senator Close.
Thank you. Director Peters, can you just tell me what is the definition exactly of contraband?
Senator Przanski, Chair Przanski, Senator Close, I do not have that definition memorized. I see that Council Taylor is looking at it right now.
Okay.
Chair, members of the committee, if you want, I will read it. 162.135 is using 162.135 to 162.05 unless the context requires otherwise. Contraband means controlled substance as defined in ORS 475.005. Drug paraphernalia is defined in ORS 475.525C, except as otherwise provided in paragraph B of the subsection. Currency possessed by or in the control of an inmate confined in a correctional facility, or A. D. An article or thing which a person confined in a correctional facility, youth correction facility, or state hospital is prohibited by statute, rule, or order from obtaining or possessing, and whose use would endanger the safety or security of such institution or any person therein. Contraband does not include an authorized currency possessed by an inmate in a work release facility.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's the definition.
Thank you.
All right, and then I guess the other question is regarding how the bill is currently written. You said some employees would not be covered. Can you give us a little bit more information on that?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The bill as written only includes those in the security series, and we have individuals, of course, in our department that don't fall into that. So there would be a substantial number of employees that wouldn't be covered and yet still have the same issues. They are still traveling long distances to the prison or other work sites and have the same security issues because they are working in direct contact with those inmates.
Other questions?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. But presumably you could change the, I mean, the reason that this is, that DAS has, it's a DAS decision to have this policy. It's a DAS policy, right? So if we were to make this change for the security personnel, DAS could change its policy to accord with that, couldn't it? For those other employees.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dembro, I do believe that it will require legislation because of the contraband statute. I think it needs to be very clear in the law that these individuals with concealed carry permits are able to bring them onto any and all of our properties.
Senator Dembro. Senator Roblin.
Yeah, and thank you for being here. The question I have is, so as you mentioned in Pendleton, you've got two parking lots, a city parking lot and another one. So is it currently the policy that if you park in the city one, you could bring it and lock it in the car, and if you come to the state one, you could not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roblin, currently we're treating those two pieces of property the same way.
Okay.
And stating that it is under the purview of the Department of Corrections. As we analyzed this and looked at the questions posed, we believe that there needs to be clarification around that issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
On that city parking lot, is it, I understand from your testimony, it's owned, is it being leased by the agency?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe it is. I think it's just an in-kind usage of that piece of property.
So if it's in-kind and we have no contractual authority over it, how can we be carrying out that type of administrative rule?
Mr. Chair, that is the question that's being posed. We may not have the authority to engage in the policy that we've been engaging in with that piece of property. So that is one of the pieces that's under review with the Department of Justice right now.
All right. Council Taylor, regarding how the bill is currently written, the issue regarding contraband, is this written in a way that says notwithstanding whatever the contraband statute is, or is it at this point potentially setting up conflict?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, notwithstanding any Department of Corrections regulation, rule, policy, or provision of employment, the corrections officer who is employed but may possess a firearm in the office personal vehicle. Chair, members of the committee, I would have to say that this would overrule the contraband statute. Last in time was first in right. There probably would be ambiguity. The contraband statute is not a model of clarity.
All right. I think we need to get clarification from legislative counsel as to whether, as it's currently written, whether it wouldn't take priority being last in time. I understand that, but where you have the conflict, I want that to be part of the record. So if we're moving forward with this, okay, we're doing it right, and we're not going to set up for some type of additional obstacle. All right. Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
We've had a number of discussions. There's no one else scheduled, but I'm going to ask specifically Mr. Sterik. I see you're here. Would you like to give testimony on House Bill 4035A? All right. For the record, no. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on House Bill 4035A? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4035A. We're going to reopen our public hearing on House Bill 4068A that was in recess. And I have two individuals that are scheduled, at least have written down that they want to give testimony. I've got Daryl Fuller and then Gordy Young, Mayor. All right. Gordy, why don't you go ahead and come on up as well. While those gentlemen are coming forward, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on House Bill 4068A? All right. Daryl, why don't you start off?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller, on behalf of the Oregon.
Yeah, go ahead and bring yourself up on the record. I need to put something on the record as well.
Daryl Fuller, on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, we requested the introduction of the bill.
All right, and because you've also had this amendment, I want to put on the record, I had council check to see when the posting occurred for that amendment. It occurred on 8:16 this morning. It's now been over an hour, and so we will take testimony not only on the bill of 4068A, but also the amendment that has been properly posted and timely noticed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Imagine, if you will, two twin brothers growing up in Eastern Oregon. They go off to college, one in Oregon and one out of state. Being twins, while they're both in college during their sophomore year, they both get arrested for possessing a small amount of marijuana. They come back home after graduating from college. They go into the family business, and several years later, they both apply for a concealed handgun license. The brother who stayed and went to school in Oregon gets a CHL, and the brother who went to college outside of the state of Oregon is denied a CHL because his conviction of a small amount of marijuana was out of state. And the current statute specifically references Oregon's law, which decriminalized marijuana and made it a violation. So sheriff's offices across the state are denying CHLs to people simply because of the location in which their marijuana violation occurred. The intent of the bill is simply to treat everybody the same, regardless of where their single conviction on a possession of a small marijuana occurred. And there were some amendments that were adopted on the House side during the work session. I didn't get a chance to review those prior to their adoption. My subject matter experts on CHLs reviewed them. There were some problems with the amendments. The biggest problem that we had a concern about is it created a definition for a diversion program, and the definition of the diversion program would require us, if a conviction was, for example, in Alaska in the 1960s, we would have to make sure that diversion diversion back in the 1960s met our current definition of a diversion program, and it was specific enough that we felt that there would be diversion programs that we would not be allowed to be used in order to get the CHL. So we've broadened what the definition of a diversion program is to make sure we can capture diversion programs from any state during any period of time previously. So we worked, my CHL expert from Marion County, along with Legislative Council and Mr. Taylor, drafted the amendments that we think makes the bill easier for the CHL experts to apply when somebody's trying to get their CHL. So we commend the A4 amendments to you and encourage you to support the bill, because as Representative Barker indicated when he testified, we really don't think this is a gun bill and we don't think it's a marijuana bill. It's just a matter of how we treat people who come into our offices and to make sure we treat them the same regardless of where their conviction occurred. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. I do want to go ahead and do questions now on this, because what I understand is that from what you testified, that there are amendments that were made on the House side that you were not part of those discussions?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. And where do those amendments come, and how do they vary from what was originally introduced, I believe, at your request?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is the amendments came from Representative Thatcher's office. You'd have to ask Representative Barker, because when the work session started, they adopted the amendments, and I don't remember him specifically indicating where the amendments had come from. But in conversations afterwards, I seem to recall him saying that they'd come from Representative Thatcher's office. They created the statutory definition of what a diversion program was. Our original bill doesn't have a definition. It simply refers to a court-ordered diversion program, and we believe that was sufficient enough for the CHL experts to check the record, and if there was a diversion, then they would accept that. We modified the definition of the diversion program that was created by the amendments on the House side. We didn't eliminate it altogether. We just made sure that the definition was broad enough that we felt like we could use it. There was also apparently a mistaken reference in the amendments on the House side that potentially could have allowed somebody who had a felony conviction on marijuana possession to get a CHL. And if I recall correctly our conversation with the Legislative Council, that was simply an error on their part. And then we just did some additional cleanup on the language.
All right. So the amendment that you have before us, the A4s, would actually be considered broader in the sense that it would not look at each diversion program in a sister state, but instead said if they had a diversion program, whatever that consisted of, and they were and they completed that, that would be would not be a prohibition from being able to get an Oregon CHL.
No, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. Other questions, Council Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one thing the A version did do, it requires a person to demonstrate from the other state that they had they only have one conviction or they completed a diversion program. If I remember last night when we talked to Brian Wallace, they now have to go out and establish that, that the sheriff has to do this. This will require the person who's the one most knowledgeable about what happened to him or her in the other state. So that is one difference.
Mr. Chair, and that is a part of the amendments that were drafted on the House side that we did support. And that is the Sheriff's Office now, if somebody said they had a diversion program, we check and make sure that they actually had a diversion or that they only had a single conviction. But the language of the amended bill does require them, essentially changes the burden of proof to some degree and requires them to do it and provide us with proof that that they do qualify. Now, that being said, if somebody turns something into us, into a Sheriff's Office, that doesn't mean that we're just going to take it at face value and not do our own checking. But if there is some confusion on whether or not something qualifies or not for an exception that would allow the CHL, this does allow the Sheriff's Office to require the applicant to do the homework as opposed to putting the burden on the employees of the Office of the Sheriff.
So in other words, if someone came in with a certified copy from Alaska that said that they went through a diversion program, that would be the type of evidence to show that they did in fact go through a diversion program?
Mr. Chair, I believe that would be correct.
Other questions? All right. 40, your last name is Youngmer?
Yes, that's right.
All right. Go ahead and tell us your, you need to state your name for the record and then give us your testimony, sir.
Yeah. Well, I testimony is specifically about...
I need you to say your name for the record.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I'm Gordon Youngmeyer, and I'm a constituent working with a policy analyst, and I'm living on a low-income housing. And apparently, my testimony specifically is regarding to a lot of times I do a lot of walking 7 days a week, and I know that there's been a lot of... people moving from California to Oregon, and I know that there has been things that I know people have told me that there are danger in people that are moving from California into Oregon, and I know that there has been other sort of things that have happened in danger with people, you know, from shootings illegally, carrying unconcealed weapons that I've noticed hearing on TV and stuff like that. And as far as people who have walking, you know, out every day, and it just feels like that there should be having some sort of look at for people who might need to keep themselves protected with a concealed handgun registered. So it would be that the way to have that more safety for people who haven't been in trouble with the law or committed any crime or possession of any sort of drugs or have been influenced over alcohol, should at least have the right to have a concealed handgun, more safety instead of carrying like in a holster like an actual police officer does on their job out in the field. It would be more more valid that I would feel to have it more in concealed, like inside a coat, like inside where it's not going to be shown as a cop would pull over and being able to, you know, ask him, you know, drop to the ground, I want your hands behind your head, because apparently most people who have been very clear about not being a danger in the society for any means or any charge of being on parole or probation for any supervision, I feel that they should have at least have the right to have some kind of protection to keep themselves protected, because a lot of times when people are walking home and they want to get home before dark, and usually people who have cars apparently, you know, slow down, put on their brakes and stop like in the street somewhere, and it's really kind of strange because apparently I know a lot of people are very, you know, skeptical, a little wondered about why people slow down, because you never know, people might be, you know, danger, they might have concerns that that person could have be out looking for someone to put their life in danger, and I feel that this is kind of a big issue just for a citizen, and okay. I'm feeling that this is kind of a time right now that I've looked over this very carefully, and I'm someone who's got a pretty good recognized way about how society is. I've never been in danger, but there could be a chance later on, somewhere down the road, it could possibly it could happen to me or other people. And I feel that with the way that the weapon should be on a person, that it should have on the inside where it's strapped, where it's not going to be like, you know, out on the side of a belt in a holster, because I feel that a lot of times that society has done some pretty dangerous things, and I know that it had happened in the parks, or someone can drive along or on a parking lot, they get out, they might be sitting in their car, people may not know they're in their car, and, you know, they just may be on their way home, someone come out and easily pull out a weapon, unconcealed, it could be illegal, they could have a record of criminal past killings and stuff like that, threaten people to take their life, and I'm finding that this is a very serious issue right now for a lot of citizens who need to have, you know, a concealed handgun with a license permit to protect yourself, as long as they have it inside the jacket, so it's not being proposed as somebody could look at that and like, hey, you know, that's dangerous, you know, and that could be calling the cops. That's my testimony about the danger just for somebody that wants to keep themselves protected. So,
all right.
I don't know about the bills and how they write it up on that, but...
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. There's any questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So I'm going to ask on this bill as well, on House Bill 4068A, we now have an A4. Mr. Sterik, you're also here. I don't know if you have had a chance to look at that. Did you want to make any comments regarding the A4 or on the bill itself? We're not moving that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. I really haven't had a chance to look at the amendments next to the bill. Some of the amendments that we worked on that came out of Representative Thatcher's office were intended to do a couple of things. One of them was to cover pre-1973 convictions. I don't know if that's still in here. As far as the definition of the diversion, the reason we were trying to come with a fairly specific definition was because my experience, I've had people who've had diversions in other states, and our state refused to recognize them because they said it didn't qualify. So what we were trying to do is come up with something that would be really locked down. A person would know if he had it or not. If Mr. Fuller's amendment broadens that, we're fine with it. I don't want to say it's right or not because I haven't been able to tell. I just want to clarify why we did that. As for putting the burden of proof on the person applying, we included that, I think, because the sheriffs were concerned that they might have to start doing some research to find out who qualified and who didn't. That was why that was inserted.
Okay. So, thank you. I'd like for you to please look at the A4s. We don't have the paperwork, even if we wanted to move it today. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to carry both of these bills, House Bill 4035A, as well as 4068A, over till tomorrow. That's our next day. Realize that we have until Tuesday of next week to move bills out of the committee. As I've said at the very beginning, there has been angst that's been raised by the executive branch. I don't know where the president of the Senate is going to be. He does have authority and power under our rules that sometimes we agree with, other times we disagree with. So who's to say what that means? But at this point, this is carried over till tomorrow. We're going to see if the paperwork comes in, and we'll figure out if we can get the dust to settle, and then we'll take it up. Other questions, comments? Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was said when we were discussing 4035 that there would be a survey done of all 50 states, and I would like to request that when we do that survey, we look into this question about signing employment agreements, and does that take priority over somebody's constitutional rights? And I'd like to know how other states handle that specifically.
All right. Well, Senator Close, that was not stated that we were going to do a survey. What the testimony was is that the Department of Corrections has worked with the Department of Justice, that the Department of Justice has started that review of what's happening in those 50 states. So you may want to request the Department of Justice to include you if they will, but they are doing work for our client, and whether they will share with you their work product, I don't know. But we are not at this point and bracing on that issue in this session because we don't have enough time for that to occur. We could always look at this in the future through some type of interim work. And regarding the restrictions in employment terms and contracts, the Medford case, I do believe, addressed that and stated that that was something that could be done through a contractual obligation and commitment, if I remember correctly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. That was an issue we had to address in the House version because it did not address the contractual issue. The current version does. But under the Constitution, you can't impair contracts. So if there were a contract in existence at the time, this would only apply after that contract ended. Now, I understand with the Department of Corrections, it's not a contractual issue, it's a policy issue. So I do not believe that it's in their negotiated contract with the union that address anything that addresses this issue.
All right. Other comments?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think yes. Senator Klotz's question. The Medford teacher case, which I think is what's defining this, was a lawsuit that we brought. The courts found that they could impose a no-gun policy on an employee. A government agency could do that. I presume a private company could do that as well.
Right.
But they could not impose that on, say, myself as a visitor to the school, but they could make it a term of employment because it was not a law or an ordinance.
And my concern was, is this the way it is across 50 states, or is this individual to Oregon decisions?
And that I don't know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, under general contract law, it would be available throughout the country. Whether or not other states are doing it, that's, you know, that would be the question, I think, as compared to do they have the legality under the Commerce Clause and other statements under the federal process that would, in fact, be permissible, but whether it's actually being carried out, that would be more the appropriate question. Mr. Derrick, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 4068A? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on 4068A. And as I stated, we are carrying over till tomorrow both House Bill 4035A and House Bill 4068A. Any other work of the committee? We're adjourned.